This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal. I am in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. I hope you have all tuned in over the past few weeks. Mike and I had the pleasure of interviewing some of the top jocks up in Saratoga Springs, New York. But now I'm back flying solo today, and I want to extend a special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM 206, and to all of you tuning in on our website, on your smartphone, or on your tablet with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. Tonight's guest has quite the impressive resume. At just 29 years old, this jockey has racked up 1,392 wins, over $46 million in earnings. He has earned multiple leading rider titles, and you will all know who I'm referring to when I mention that he won the Breeders' Cup Classic in 2012 aboard Fort Larned. Jockey Brian Joseph Hernandez Jr., welcome to the show.
Hey, Christina. Thanks for having me on.
So good to have you joining us today. And first of all, I just want to say that when I was looking up your stats, I saw that this past Saturday was a great day for you. You shipped to Parks to ride Island Town to victory in the Grade 3 Smarty Jones Stakes. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, got lucky and picked up a really nice three-year-old there.
That's great to ship in there and grab the win.
Yeah, it is. It is. Anytime you get to ride a nice horse like that, it's always great. And to get that opportunity on another good one, it makes it fun.
Of course, for a great connection you have with trainer Ian Wilkes. And let me start out by asking you this. What is it like for you to ship into a racetrack for a day, a racetrack that might either be totally new to you or a racetrack you don't ride frequently at? And what is it you do to prepare to get a feel for the racetrack?
Normally when I ship into somewhere, I'll get there early and get in the jocks room and watch the races all day long and just see how the racetrack's playing and kind of figure out the best options for the horses I ride for that day.
Do you try to pick up any mounts earlier in the card?
Yeah, sometimes I get my agent to go ahead and try to name us on something just so we can get a feel over the track. You know, it's always better to have a little experience over a racetrack going into a big race, but sometimes if you're on the right horse, you don't even need to worry about that.
That is true, and it worked out Saturday with Island Town.
Yes, it did. It sure did.
Well, let's rewind a little bit before we go any further, and let's start at the beginning. Let's go back to 1989. You were 3 years old, if I did the math correctly, and your father, Brian Hernandez Sr., had just started his riding career in Louisiana. And, of course, I don't expect you to remember a lot from the age of three, but take us back to the beginning.
No, I mean, growing up in Louisiana, we always grew up around horses, and horses were always there. Dad took us on the backside of Evangeline our whole lives. We grew up on the backside there, me and my little brother, Colby. And racing was always there for us. It was a great environment growing up down there in Louisiana.
So I guess that was always in your memory. You just always remember going to the racetrack.
Yeah, I remember always going to the racetrack. And this trainer down there, he had this old white horse that they'd let me ride around the barn every morning. So it was always a highlight to get to go out and ride around the barn in an exercise saddle.
Of course. How old were you at that time, Brian?
I was about 7.
Wow. So is that the first time you sat on a horse?
No, I mean, we had riding horses our whole lives. I mean, from the moment we could walk and talk, we were on the back of horses riding Shetland ponies and and Welsh's. Me and Colby, we used to race them through the pasture all day long until Dad would come out and scream at us for running the horses around in the 100-degree weather.
Wow. So you come from a family of five children, is that right?
Yeah, four.
Four,
yep. Yeah, I have two little brothers and a sister.
Wow, and a few of them have also gone to the racetrack to pursue riding careers.
Yeah, I mean, Kobe's been leading rider down there at Evangeline and Delta the last couple of years. And then my little sister, Courtney, she was riding for a while, and she just quit to find something else to do.
Sure. Well, it's not for everyone, but you've stuck with it. And you are a member of the fine group of riders to come out of Louisiana and maybe one of the last to have experienced the infamous bush tracks.
Yes, yeah. I got lucky, and I was one of the last guys that got to ride on the bush tracks when I was like 11 and 12. Dad would take me there on the weekends, and we'd ride the quarter horses and the Welshes and the Shetlands and anything else we can get named on. It was a fun experience.
We've interviewed a few jockeys who had a similar experience, and tell us about yours. What was that like to be such a young age and to experience the bush tracks?
It was interesting because, I mean, growing up down there, it's part of life, so you think it's normal, but now looking back at it, you think about the crazy stuff we did, like running against horses with nobody on them and things like that. And now it seems crazy, but back then that was normal life because that's what we did every weekend. That was our form of entertainment.
Sure. And there were really no rules, I guess, when it applied.
No, there was no rules. There were no stewards, and people did whatever they wanted, and it kind of, you know, everybody took every advantage they could to try to beat the next guy.
Sure. Was there anyone riding at that time at the bush tracks with you that you now ride with professionally?
No, not really. I mean, those guys that were riding there at the bush track at the time, they were riders down there at Evangeline as well, but I don't think any of them are riding anymore.
Sure. So you started high school, and I hear that you were trying to fill your days up with both education and learning how to ride.
Yeah, actually, the whole time from the minute I was in eighth grade until I graduated high school, I worked for a guy on a farm named Del Angel, and he gave me my start, and I worked a lot of horses for a lot of guys back home. But the whole way through high school, I'd work on the weekends, and then I'd ride, I'd gallop horses and go to school on the weekdays. And then my senior year of high school, I rode at night. My dad would drive me back and forth to Delta Downs. Me and him, we'd ride together because he was riding at the time as well. And he'd drive and I'd sleep, and then we'd ride all night and then drive back and go to work in the mornings, gallop horses, and then go to school from 11 in the morning, I think, until 2 or something.
Well, that's dedication right there.
Yeah, it was well worth it, though.
Well, of course. You mentioned a name. You galloped for Mr. Angel, and I've run across that name when researching you, and I guess your dad rode for him, and
yes,
he kind of, I guess, was the one who taught you a lot.
Yeah, down there on Dale's farm, I mean, he dad was galloping for him and riding everything for him, and between those two guys, they taught us a lot on how to get along with a horse and a lot of old school methods of just horsemanship.
Old school methods. What would you say those were?
Just knowing a lot about the horse and knowing the tendencies of a horse, and it wasn't just about going out and riding, you know, it was more of we didn't just ride. Everything you galloped, you had to clean the stalls, groom them, do them up. It was an all-day process. And then after we were done with the horses, Dale would have us pack on the weed eaters and the poison packs and go poison the fences around the track. And it was a dedicated job that didn't pay very well, but it was a great learning experience.
Started from the ground up.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is as many good riders have started out and is obviously the best way, I would say, to learn how to work around a horse.
It is. It just makes you appreciate the whole process.
Exactly. When you get those few minutes on the back of a horse and so many people have done so much work with those horses, you kind of appreciate all the work that's been done.
Exactly. I mean, riders riding races, you get a whole lot of glory, but the guys that are there every morning and every night, they're the true heroes, the ones taking care of the horses every day.
Exactly. Now, you were going to high school while you were doing all of this, and was there ever a moment in time when you thought about just quitting school and focusing on your riding career?
No, because, I mean, my parents, they instilled that in us that if we wanted to, whatever we wanted to do in our careers, in our lives, that we needed to go ahead and finish high school first. And that was something that they were really strong about. And I was fortunate enough that they allowed me to start riding while I was in high school. And I got very fortunate, and I was pretty successful at it. And so I just wanted to go ahead and fulfill those dreams for them, because, like my father, he never got the chance to finish high school. He started working in the dry cleaners when he was 15, and he never got that chance. So I wanted to kind of do that for them.
Wow. Wow. And what did your dad think when you decided you wanted to pursue riding? Was there ever any kind of hesitation? Was there any fear that he felt?
No, I mean, the biggest thing was they just wanted to make sure that before we started riding, we were ready to start. We were ready to ride. He wasn't going to let me just go out there and not be ready to do it. He wanted to make sure that all the T's and I's were crossed and dotted, and just to make sure we were ready when it was time to do it.
Sure, sure. And do you remember that time? Do you remember when you were galloping and breezing horses and maybe your dad came up to you and you knew you were ready to start riding?
Yeah, it was actually a funny story, because we never told my mom about it. We just went over. Dale and my dad took me over to Delta one morning and got me okayed out the gates to start riding and stuff like that. And I went and met the stewards and got my license. And they named me on a horse, and that's when mom first found out that I was going to go ahead and start riding.
What a way to find out.
Yeah.
Do you remember that first race?
Yeah, I do. It was a horse going 5/8 of a mile at Delta for Chad Hassenflug. And horse had been running at Los Alamitos going 870. And Chad ran in for the first time over there at Delta going 5/8. And she broke fast and put me on the lead, and I ended up getting run down like the last 60 yards or something.
Ah, oh, so close. So close. How long did it take before you got your first winner?
It was actually, I think, like the next week. I rode a horse for Doris Hebert, Bill and Kay's Phone Trick, and got lucky. I rode a really bad race, but horse was the best horse in the race. Dropped my whip and everything else and still got lucky and won.
Hey, there you go. Do you remember riding with your dad in those early days?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it was always great. I mean, anytime riding with him, it was fun, because I had a guy in the room that after every race, no matter if I did something right or wrong, he'd come back and tell me, you know, hey, do this, do that, improve here. And it was just a big help to have that mentor. And I actually have a picture hanging in my house now of one of the races that when I first started riding, Dad beat me by a head, and the photographer wrote senior school's junior. And we have the picture hanging there in the house.
That's fantastic. That is awesome. Would you say your dad was your biggest influence on your riding style?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, growing up down there in Louisiana at that time, I watched a lot of races from around the country. But knowing that guys like him and being able to watch him, because he always rode a really smart race, and he was a big influence on just learning how to figure a race out.
Sure, sure. And would he teach you how to handicap a race from a rider's perspective?
Yeah, he did. And I was fortunate enough, too, because he was riding at the fairgrounds a lot before I started riding. And the clerk of scales there at the fairgrounds would let me go sit in the jocks room all day long. And I'd sit there and just listen to those guys come back and listen to them talk about a race. And I did that for like 4 years.
Wow.
Just kind of learning things and learning what to say and what not to say, and just kind of handle yourself professionally.
What a great thing to experience, definitely. Definitely. And so you were in high school. To rewind just a little bit, you were in high school and you were riding there in Louisiana, and your days were packed, busy, riding night and day and working and going to school. And then you finally graduate high school.
Yeah.
And were you thinking at that time? Were you thinking you're gonna stay? What were you thinking?
No, I mean I was riding Eddie Vanslin and I was leading rider, but right after, while I was still in high school, around when I first started riding, and it was December of that year, Shane Sellers was riding over at the fairgrounds, and he was coming over to Delta every weekend to ride the stakes. And he sat down and talked to me and my dad a couple different times, and he helped set it up to where after I graduated high school, I'd go ahead and take his agent up here in Kentucky, which was Fred Amy at the time, and they just had it all planned out for me to where the day after I graduated high school, me and Dad packed up the truck and we drove up here and I started riding here at Churchill for the 6 weeks of the spring meet.
Wow, that's fantastic. Shane Sellers is a wonderful person. We've had him on the show as well, and he's helped out many a young rider.
Yes, he has.
And so your dad went with you to Kentucky?
Yeah, he came with me and just drove me up, and then he flew back home.
Okay. Okay. How was it to move away from home for the first time?
It was tough. It was tough because I was 18. It was the first time I was away from home. I was living in a hotel room down by the track. I mean, and I was homesick the whole time. I stayed 6 weeks through the end of the spring meet, but it was hard just being away because it's the first time, you know, you're a young kid, you're away from home. And I had so much success in Louisiana at the time, going at the time, that I kind of just wanted to be back at Evangeline doing well. But I was doing so good at Churchill that I had to stick it out through the end of the spring meet.
Sure, sure. And did you find that happened immediately whenever you went up to Churchill? Did you immediately get that success you wanted, or was it a gradual process?
No, I mean, I had the bug and we did well. I came up for the spring meet, that spring meet of 04, and I won quite a few races because I came in late after I graduated high school, and then I finished out the meet, and then it was time for everybody to move on either to Saratoga or Ellis, and I decided that I wanted to go back home for a while.
Sure, sure. And being homesick had to help that decision a little bit.
Yeah, it did. It pushed it a whole lot easier. And plus, after the spring meet at Churchill, and I did go back to Evangeline, you know, the guys I was riding a lot for Dale and Keith Bourgeois and Doris Aver and those guys, they all welcomed me right back with open arms, and I went on and had a very successful meet at Evangeline that summer.
Sure, sure. And do you remember bringing anything back with you to Louisiana that you learned in Kentucky, that you learned from riding with that colony in Kentucky?
Yeah, I mean, the minute when I got back to Evangeline after riding the 6 weeks at Churchill, it was just, you become a better polished rider, and you're able to notice it. I mean, you learn so much riding with, it's just like with any competition, anytime you compete with the best or with better athletes, you're going to improve yourself.
Sure, sure. And do you remember anyone in particular who really took you under their wing there at Churchill?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really close to Calvin Burrell. We're in the same corner, and so from day one and to this day now, he's always kind of helped me out and showed me little things, and he's just a great, great guy to be around.
Sure, sure. I remember I rode my first race at Churchill, and Calvin was next to me in the gate, and I was so nervous, and Calvin was just, oh, relax, it's okay.
Yeah.
You got it.
And that,
great
that's
guy.
His personality.
Great
He's
guy.
Great about it.
Great guy. Great guy. And so to go back, as you said, you returned to Evangeline, and you captured your first riding title there.
Yes, I did. I got lucky, and it was the last year they ran at the old track before they moved it to St. Landry Parish, and we got down there and ended up still making lead rider after missing 6 weeks of the meet.
Which is quite impressive to come late in the meet and to capture a title like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good because, I mean, the guys I was down there riding for, they were the top guys. They were the top three trainers between Keith Bourgeois and Dale Angel and Doris Aber at the time. They had the best horses, and I was fortunate enough to be riding them at the time.
Of course, of course. And where did you go after that meet?
After that meet, I came home, and then after the Evangeline meet was over, I came back up to Kentucky here to get ready for Turfway and Kentucky Down.
Sure, sure.
It was back to Kentucky, and then after that big summer we had at Evangeline, Eclipse Award for Apprentice of the Year started to kind of play into fact. So we needed to kind of get rolling and win some pretty good races.
And you definitely won some pretty good races. 243 yeah. victories that year, over $4 million in earnings that first year of riding. And you earned the Eclipse Award for Outstanding Apprentice.
Yeah, sure did.
How was that? How was that to be there at the ceremony? And did it click it then was, that you made it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was a little nervous because we didn't know for sure if we were going to win it. I mean, there was a couple other good apprentices that year. But it was surreal to be able to, these guys you watch win Triple Crown races all year long, all your life, and then all of a sudden you're sitting in the same ballroom having dinner with them.
Sure. Quite the accomplishment. Was your family there to help you celebrate?
Yeah, my mom and dad flew out with us. They came, and we had a really good time.
That's fantastic. That has to be just an amazing experience to have worked so hard through high school and to do so well, and not long after getting your first riding title, you win the Eclipse Award. What a feeling that has to be.
Yeah, it was great because it was a goal. It was a goal that was always in the back of my mind from the day we started riding, but I wasn't quite sure if I was going to be good enough. And to be able to accomplish it at the end of the year was a great thing.
Sure, of course. And it was just quite a fantastic year. I read your stats, and you were quite the traveler that first year. You won stakes at Fairgrounds, Churchill, Remington, and Delta Downs that year. That has to be a little bit exhausting.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know it at the time. I was an 18-year-old kid, and I was riding a lot for Steve Asmussen, and that was at the time where he was winning 350 races a year, so he had us flying different places to ride. And it was a lot of fun to be able to ride good horses and horses that were going to be competitive in those kind of stakes at the time.
Of course. I'm sure you were more focused on just being happy to have that opportunity versus being tired,
exactly.
Tired, I suppose.
Exactly.
So following that breakthrough apprentice year, you established yourself in Kentucky and you worked hard as you always do, but things were a little bit slow for a while.
Yeah, they were. I mean, anytime you lose the bug like that and you're the young guy in the room, now you don't have that weight advantage, and you look up and you're competing against guys like Calvin Burrell, Robbie Alvarado, and guys like that at the time, that it's hard to break in. And the one thing about this circuit here in Kentucky is these guys here that train and own horses, they're pretty loyal to the guys they use. So it just takes you a while you got to settle down and just bid your time and wait for your turn to break in.
Sure. And loyalty is a wonderful thing, which is not always found at the racetrack, but it's just hard to get in sometimes, of course. Now you were talking about the weight advantage with an apprentice, and again, I remember very well, I'm tall for a jockey, and so whenever I lost the bug, it was just a relief not to have to work so hard on my weight. But do you have to worry about your weight at all?
No, not really. I try to stay pretty active, and just on the dark days, you just kind of watch what you eat and wear a sweatsuit a few of the dark days just to kind of keep my weight on average what it needs to be.
Sure. And I suppose for you, when you lost the bug, it wasn't such a relief as it was for me.
Yeah, no, it was okay the first 6 months. And then after that, your business starts kind of dwindling down and people aren't using you as much. And then you just got to work your way through it.
Sure. And I believe you made a phone call to your father during that time.
I did. I was, it was like back in 05, I guess. I wasn't doing any good at Churchill. I was just kind of struggling along. And I called him up and told him, I said, look, man, this isn't working out. I'm not doing any good. I said, I'm just going to come home to Louisiana. Can you rent a U-Haul and come help me move my stuff back home? So he was like, yeah, sure, no problem. So about a week goes by, and he was supposed to come on the Tuesday. Well, I got lucky the Saturday before he was coming and picked up a really nice horse for Niall O'Callaghan. His horse, the horse's name was Ascertain. And the horse won a big allowance race at Churchill that Saturday, the feature. So, and then after that horse won, I had something to look forward to again. So I called him up and I said, hey, look, I'm going to go ahead and stick it out a while longer. I'm going to see how it works out. And that was a big turning point in my career, because after that, I never never made that phone call again and never attempted to make that phone call again.
Wow. So close. That was perfect timing.
Yep.
Perfect timing. Well, Brian, we are right at our break, so we will continue our visit with jockey Brian Hernandez after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hey, I'm Chantel Sutherland Cruz, and want to tell you all about BetAmerica.com. It's the coolest place to bet on horse racing on over 200 racetracks from America and around the world. New players receive a 100% bonus on your first deposit, up to $300. That's the best sign-up bonus available today. It's time to play the BetAmerica way.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
They come to the top of the lane. Fort Lana de Lida, Mucho Macho Man, and now Game On Dude can go on. Game On Dude not going on. Flat Out is coming after them in the center, but it is Fort Lana digging deep. He's trying to hold on. Fort Lana along the inside. Mucho Macho Man right up alongside of him. What a thriller in the Breeders' Cup Classic. Fort Lana digs deep. Mucho Macho Man, it's nose and nose to the wire. Fort Larned has won it. That move on the far turn, the deciding factor. Fort Larned and Brian Hernandez have won it. Mucho Macho Man. Then it'll be Flat Out Richard Kidd running on late.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Christina McManigal joined tonight by jockey Brian Hernandez Jr. and we just heard the replay of the 2012 Breeders' Cup Classic. Brian was aboard Fort Larned, of course. And Brian, we're going to cover that in depth here in a little bit. But first of all, let's go back to where we left off. And we were talking about how you almost left Kentucky.
Yeah, I mean, it was close, but luckily I stuck it out.
Luckily for sure, because things definitely began to pick up. And when did the next big breakthrough moment of your career occur?
The next one was probably a couple years later. I got lucky and was riding a lot of horses for Hal Wiggins at the time. And then, boom, up comes Rachel Alexander, and she was awesome. I got to ride her first five starts, and it just that was the first really, really good horse I got to ride.
What was that like? Did you know she had that kind of potential early on?
Yeah, we were always really high on her. I remember I worked her one morning, and when I rode her first time out, she got beat, and I came back and told my valet that she got beat today, but watch this filly, she's going to be a Hall of Famer at one point.
Wow.
And luckily enough, I was correct.
You're absolutely right. Wow. Wow, and you also had the opportunity to ride Summerlee early on in her career.
Yeah, I did. I got lucky and rode Summerlee as well in the Goldenrod, there at Churchill, and I think I was third or fourth on her. And then she came back the next year and won the Oaks with Bailey.
Wow.
We've been pretty fortunate enough to ride some pretty good horses.
Absolutely. But is it a little bit frustrating that when these horses get to their peaks in their career, when you were early on in your career, that you didn't have those opportunities to continue to ride those horses?
It was at the time, but now looking back at it, you got to realize that, I mean, anytime a trainer can get a Hall of Famer that knows how to ride good horses in good races, they have to go with that route. It's only fitting. I mean, you have to give your horse and your owners the best chance you can.
Sure, sure. And Brian, you seem to have a great skill at staying level-headed, and you don't seem to get too excited, but you don't get too down, and that's kind of a quality that you have to have as a jockey. And tell us how you managed to do that.
I guess it's something that I learned from my parents, and just associating yourself with the right kind of people. You got to just kind of hang in there, and your time will come eventually. It's just, you got to realize in this game, there was a lot of guys that came before you that worked their way to the top spot. So you just got to keep working hard, and hopefully one day you'll get there.
Sure, sure. And they came up the same way you did and had to put in the same hard work, and that's a great way to look at it.
Exactly.
And another example of this, you rode a horse by the name of Cash Refund. Tell us about that horse.
Yeah, Cash Refund. He was fast. He had a funky way of going, but he was fast. And he was one of those horses that just got lucky and got to ride him first time out. Some other guy was working him, and he had another call in the race. And so I picked him up at the draw, and he ended up winning first time out. And he just kept getting good, kept getting better and better, and won quite a few stakes on him. And the good thing about Cash Refund is his owners, the Klein family, they're really good people, and they've been loyal to me just my whole career, and I was lucky enough to ride a good horse for him.
Sure, sure. And that horse actually ran in the 2010 Breeders' Cup Sprint. Fortunately, you didn't have the opportunity to ride him there, but what was that like to watch him run in that?
Yeah, I mean, Richard called me when he decided to run in the sprint, and he told me, he said, look, we're going to go with Johnny V because he has the Breeders' Cup experience and everything else. And like he said, he wanted a rider that had the experience. And at the time I said, okay, that's your choice. So that's the route they went.
Sure. Sure. And again, just another example of how you have to stay level headed and not get too down when such things happen in this kind of an industry.
Exactly. You can't let one horse get you fired for the rest of your career.
Exactly. And Brian, how do you think that you progressed as a rider during this time when you were riding such quality horses? How do you think that helps your riding talent improve?
It teaches you as you progress, it teaches you how to ride a race better and how to ride a good horse better. I mean, a good horse is probably the easiest thing in the world to ride because they know what they're doing out there and they know how to get the job done. A lot of times as a young rider, the biggest thing you got to learn is just to stay out their way.
Sure, sure. And confidence too has to.
Yeah, a lot of confidence. And you got to bring a lot of confidence into your horse and into the whole program. Because if you don't have the confidence in the horse, he's going to know it most of the time.
That's absolutely correct. And tell us, how do you do that? Sometimes maybe a certain horse, you look at the program and you think, we're in a tough spot today. How do you go out there fully confident?
You got to have an idea where you're going to be at in the race and give the horse the best trip you can. Because most of the time, if you give him a clean trip from the second turn home, if he's good enough, he's going to get there.
Sure. And that's very well put. And so we're going to talk a little bit here about the Breeders' Cup. You didn't get that chance with Cash Refund. However, on November 10th, 2011, Calvin Burrell, your friend, rode Fort Larned to a 10th place finish in an allowance race at Churchill. And tell us what happened after that.
Yeah, I was riding a few for Ian at the time. I wasn't riding a whole lot. I was working a whole lot of horses at the time, and he was giving me a few chances. And then that day there, I was named on Fort Larned, which he was just another 1X another, no, it was a two other Dan, another two other Dan on a dark, rainy, cold day at Churchill in the fall. And the race had rained off the grass and it was on a muddy track. So I rode him and he won impressively. He came through a tight spot up the fence. It was the first time he even put blinkers on him. He won impressively and just kind of forgot about him, really. It was fall time and it was time for us to move on to the fairgrounds and Ian was moving on to Tampa and Gulfstream at the time. And then I looked up and it was, I think, the middle of January. I look up and there he is. He's winning a stake at Tampa. And I was like, oh, wow, that horse has gotten good. And I kind of followed him a little bit through that winter there while he was running at Gulfstream and stuff. And he just kept getting better and better.
Wow. Did you know that day when you won with him at Churchill, did you know he would be all right? Did you have any idea?
Yeah, I mean, I thought anytime you win a two other Dan on a two other Dan at Churchill on an older boy, they're going to go on and be decent horses. But I never expected to win a Breeders' Cup Classic on him the next fall.
Wow. How did you end up getting the mount back after you went to Louisiana and you saw him winning a stake?
He came back to Kentucky and Javier Castellano rode him in the Ali Sheba and he ran a really big race. And then Julian Leferrou rode him back in the Stephen Foster and he ran bad in the Stephen Foster. Ian said he just didn't have him quite right. So he hurried up and wheeled him back in the Cornhusker. And the Cornhusker race, Julian had to ride Successful Dan at the time. And I was going to be in Iowa that night to ride a filly in the Iowa Oaks for Rusty Arnold. And just so happened with me being there that night, Ian went ahead and let me ride him back. And then he won the Cornhusker. And then after that, we rode him every time.
Wow. That's fantastic. I read that in the winner's circle for that Cornhusker handicap, Ian Wilkes told you that the owner, Janice, with him wanted you as Fort Larned's jockey for the rest of the year.
Yes, yes, that's exactly what Mrs. Whittem said at the time.
That is great to hear.
Yeah, it's great. It's just for them to have that kind of confidence in me on that kind of horse.
Absolutely. And so take us to the Breeders' Cup.
The Breeders' Cup was great. I mean, we went on to Saratoga next, and he went up to Saratoga, and I stayed at Ellis, and I flew up and rode him in the Whitney. And going into the Whitney, I've never had so much confidence in a horse. And that was the first grade one I had ever won. And just, he put so much confidence in you when he was right that you didn't ever have to worry about anything. And riding for Ian made it a whole lot easier because he knew when the horse was ready, and he knew when we were going to run a big race. And he'd just tell me, hey, go out there and have fun. And that's what we do. We go out there and let Fort Larned do his thing and have fun with him.
Wow. Wow. And Saratoga, shipping up there, I believe that was your first time at Saratoga, yes?
Yes, it was the first time at Saratoga. And at that time, I didn't realize how big of a deal winning the Whitney was. Because we went out to dinner that night after the race and stuff, and everybody in town's congratulating you, knowing who you are and everything else. And I didn't realize how big of a win that was until last year when I went back to Saratoga for the summer.
Quite a big deal indeed.
Yeah, yes, it is.
So you finally get to the Breeders' Cup and keep the mount, and that had to be such a surreal experience just to be out there for that in the Classic and in the post parade with all those people. Take us to that day.
Yeah, it was. Me and my wife flew up the night before, and it was just a real surreal moment. We got into the hotel. We slept great that night. Went over to the track, checked out Fort Larned that morning. And just all day long, I read the form and stuff like that. And we just had a whole lot of confidence in him that day that he'd be able to get the job done. For some reason, there was something that just said, hey, we're going to win this race today. And it was just having a whole lot of confidence in our horse, I believe.
That's a great feeling to have. Were you nervous at all? Were there any nerves?
No, you know what? Not at all. Because, like I said, I had so much confidence in my horse that he can get the job done. That it just made everything so easy and so smooth that I just had to, trust him. That was the biggest thing. Just trust him and have fun.
Of course, of course. And what a thrilling stretch run we heard during the break. And you beat Mucho Macho Man, Game On Dude, and jockeys like Mike Smith, and just what an incredible experience that had to be.
Yes, it was, and we were fortunate enough to where we made, that day we made all the right moves. We were able to leave there fast enough to output Game On Dude the first step, and we were able to just kind of take his spot and race ride him a little out the gate. And then from there, it was just such a smooth trip on, and letting Fort Laurney get in his big, fast rhythm. And turning for home, I thought, I said, oh, God, I'm about to win the Breeders' Cup Classic by 10. And then Mucho Macho Man hooked him, and he would never let him by. He just dug it out and showed a heart of a champion.
No, absolutely. And quite the masterful ride by the jockey as well. And that was also your 27th birthday, yes?
Yeah, it was. It was the greatest birthday present that a jockey can ever get.
I would say so. To win the $5 million Classic, that has to be the best gift ever.
Yes, it does.
That's fantastic. So did you find that after that victory, people really started to take notice of you?
Yeah, I mean, people entrusted me with better horses, and I was fortunate enough. I've been fortunate enough now to ride better horses, and people kind of have that confidence in you now when you go out to ride bigger races. That hey, this guy's been to the top stage, and he didn't stumble. He persevered through it.
Jockey Brian Hernandez joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Just talking about his masterful ride aboard Fort Larned in the Breeders' Cup Classic. And Brian, after that victory, you continued to ride nice horses for Mr. Wilkes, and you really started to get noticed, as you said.
And yeah, that, yeah, we got lucky and won the Indiana Oaks and the Indiana Derby that same year, that on the same day. We were
that had to be nice. You picked up a mount, I believe, too, that day.
Yeah, I did. Ramon Dominguez, he was named on Grace Hall at Indiana, but he was also named on horses at Saratoga, and he couldn't make it to ride Grace Hall that day in Indiana, and she was like 2-5 in the Oaks, and we were fortunate enough that Michael Dubb, the owner, had seen us win the Whitney at Saratoga earlier that year, so they had confidence to go ahead and name me on, and I got lucky and won the race for him.
Well, I would say that was a successful trip to Indiana.
Yeah, it was a very successful trip. We won the Oaksford with Grace Hall, and then neck and neck went ahead later that day and won the Indiana Derby for us.
Can't beat those kind of days, absolutely not.
No, exactly. They're few and far between.
Appreciate them when they do come, right?
Yes, very much.
So, Brian, tell us, what's been happening lately? What's your career look like now?
Oh, the career is great. I mean, I'm in a great place now. I'm married, and then I have our little girl. We had a little girl last year. She'll be a year next week, and it's just a whole lot of fun to be able to go to the track every day and work good horses and ride nice horses and then get to go home to the little girl.
That's fantastic. What's her name?
Jocelyn.
Jocelyn
Marie. Yeah.
I like that. How did you and your wife meet?
She was an assistant trainer for Steve Asmussen, and she came down to New Orleans for her first year down there, and we met because I was riding for Steve at the time, and we just kind of, it just kicked off.
And that was how long ago?
That was in 2008.
Wow, fantastic. Well, that's awesome to hear. Like you said, it's has to be so great to have such a successful career and then share it with your family, and that's something really great.
Yeah, exactly. It makes it that much more appreciative.
How is it for your wife? Does she ever worry when she watches you ride?
No, she knows the game. She grew up in the sport. Her parents trained, and she's had a couple brothers that rode, and she understands the whole aspect of it, which makes it a whole lot easier, because this isn't the easiest life to live, the whole traveling and everything else, but she understands it, so it makes it a lot easier.
That is a, you said it, absolutely. It is a difficult lifestyle, and that's good that she understands, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure, the jockey's life is not easy. And
yeah.
Brian, tell us, do you occupy your time whenever you're not riding? You said sometimes you wear a sweatsuit on your days off to maintain that weight. Do you go to the gym? Do you work out or do anything like that?
No, I don't work out a whole lot. I hate going to the gym, really, but I do like to play a lot of golf. I'm actually sitting out here at the golf course right now, but play a lot of golf and just kind of twiddle around the house, do the yard, stuff like that.
Sure, sure. I hope I'm not keeping you from a game.
Oh, no, you're good. We got a few minutes.
Okay, good. Are you good?
I'd like to say I was, but some days you are, some days you're not. I try to keep myself in lesser competition.
Do you play with any of the other riders you ride with?
Yeah, I play with quite a few riders. Actually, today I'm playing with Corey Lannery and a couple of the other guys that ride out at Churchill.
Sure, sure. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
I hope you do well. I don't play golf, so I don't really understand.
No.
I don't have the patience, I don't think. But so, Brian, tell me, what career goals are you still working towards?
Just to ride good horses, really. I mean, that's what you get up every day for. You're looking for that next year. Every morning you go out to Churchill and everywhere else, and you're looking for that next two-year-old, hopefully that next two-year-old that'll take you to the Derby and to big races. And just good horses is the biggest thing.
Of course, of course. And so you rode in the Preakness Stakes, I believe it was 2013 with Departed. Was that your first Triple Crown race?
Yes, that was the first Triple Crown race I rode in. I was able to ride Departing for Claiborne.
Fantastic. You have not yet had an opportunity to ride in the Derby yet, have you?
No, I haven't ridden any Derbies yet. It seems like every year we get closer and closer, and right before Derby, the horse either gets hurt or it just doesn't pan out to where they make it into the field. I was actually named on a horse this year in the Derby on the AEs, and he didn't draw in. I was named on Tale of Irv in the Derby, and he didn't draw in.
Oh, so close, so close.
Yeah.
Well, it's you're knocking on the door. You're
yeah,
close.
Exactly. We're getting closer every year, so hopefully, by the time we do get to ride the Derby, we're not just riding the Derby, we're winning the Derby. That's the goal.
Absolutely, absolutely. You have a Breeders' Cup Classic you can mark off the list. Now you need the Derby.
That would be great.
And do you see yourself sticking to this circuit you've kind of established for yourself, the Kentucky circuit?
Yeah, I think so, because I really love it. Love living here in Louisville. The people are nice. There's a saying here in Louisville that you meet a lot of like executives and stuff like that leave Louisville, but they, for some reason, they always tend to come back because it's just a great city to live in. And me and my wife are fortunate. We have a home here in Louisville, and then we have a home in New Orleans. So it makes it nice and neat, simple when we have to travel.
Well, of course, of course. And I live in Lexington, so I'm a little bit competitive with
basketball
teams. Yeah, you know about
the lifestyle.
You know, but absolutely, traveling can be tough, especially with a family. So, like I said, it's great that she understands that, but it's also great that you do have a home. And as you mentioned early on in your career, you're not just living out of hotel rooms.
Yes, exactly. It makes it a lot easier to raise a family.
Absolutely. We've all been there. That is never fun. Never fun. But tell me about your agent. Describe the relationship between you and your agent.
Oh, Frank Bernice is great. I mean, we started working together in 2012, and that was the our biggest year together. But he's really laid back, which I like, and he's simple. He watches all the races, and he knows the game. He worked for Tom Amos for 22 years. He was Tom Amos's top assistant for 22 years. And he just makes it really easy to work with. He doesn't tell me how to ride a race. I don't tell him what horses to ride or what to do, and we get along really well.
And that is very important, of course, because an agent develops those relationships with trainers too, and so to have a good agent is
and that's the thing with Frank is he gets along with everyone, and he handles his business in a very professional manner, and he doesn't upset anyone, so people have a lot of confidence in him to call him and depend on him.
Sure, and that's a sometimes hard thing to find.
Yes, it is. A great agent, they're rare to find.
It's very, very true. Very true. Brian, tell me, what if your daughter, when she, obviously she's very young now, but when she grows up, when she's in high school, what if she approaches you and she says, "Dad, I want to be a jockey"?
I guess that's something that we'll just have to deal with and let her decide. I know one thing though. She is already horse crazy. We have a couple horses out at the farm that my wife keeps in quarter horses, and she loves going out there and climbing on them and riding them around. She has a lot of fun doing it.
Watch out! Watch out!
Yeah, we're already in trouble. She's already horse crazy. I'm sure it'll get expensive here in a couple years when she decides she wants her own pony.
So do you all ride your wife's horses on your days off frequently?
Yeah, we go out to the farm there. It's only about 10 minutes from our house, and we take the baby and let her ride, and we'll ride around with her. And my wife's a horse nut as well, so she loves going out there to the farm and being with them, and it's just a good experience to raise the baby like that.
Oh, of course, and to teach her the hard work that you went through as a young man.
Yeah. Yeah, and try to instill the best we can into her.
Exactly. So Brian, I'm going to ask you another question. If you hadn't chosen this career, if you had not chosen to ride, what do you think you would have done?
I don't know. I guess I'd probably be down in Louisiana, Lafayette, Louisiana, probably working on the oil field or something else like that. I don't know. I never really, that was the thing all through high school and growing up. I never thought about doing anything else except for working on the racetrack.
Well, and it's a very good thing that you chose this profession. You're still so early on in your career, and you have so much more ahead of you. Take me through a typical day in your life, Brian. Like, what on a day that you're going to ride, what is the typical day?
Normally, when I'm here at Churchill in the spring and the fall, I would get up at 5 and get up and head to the track. My first work is normally by 6. And I'll have 4 or 5 workers a day, work my horses and kind of mingle around a while, and then normally leave the track about 9:30, come home, drive back to the house here in Louisville, and come home and shower and change. And then my wife will ride in to work with me in the afternoons because she works in the photography's office now at Churchill. And we'll ride the races that day during the card. And then after the races are done, go home at night, have dinner and play with the baby, and then go to bed and start all over the next day.
Sounds good. Sounds like a great life, Brian. And,
yeah,
and
it's fun.
that's fantastic. How do you prep for a race in the room?
A lot of times I have the iPad, so I watch a lot of the horses replays, and then with the form you figure out where you kind of get an idea where your horse needs to be and where everybody else is going to be, and just have a somewhat game plan of what's going to go on out there to where you're not just going out there and going, man, I hope this works out.
That's always good. You always have to have plan A, plan B, and plan C, as you know.
Yeah, exactly. And some races you just go, oh, well, this ain't going to work, so let's try. Let's just wing it.
That is very true, because sometimes out of the gate, your plan has completely failed, whatever it might be.
Exactly. Sometimes they stumble and fall down, and then it's over. You can never fail.
Exactly. You never know. You never know. And as you learned, actually, with Fort Larned on his return at Gulfstream Park that day.
Exactly. That was a prime example. That was a tough day, because the whole way in the post parade, he warmed up so good in the post parade. And going to the gates, I said, all he's got to do is break, and he's going to set a track record. And then, sure enough, he stumbled and fell down.
And still won, but by himself.
Yeah, exactly, and left me in the dirt.
Well, thankfully, no harm was done. And Brian, unfortunately, we've run out of time. If you've missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out the podcast on our website, horseracingradio.net, and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kristen. Thanks for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
This was a blast. And so for our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal. Thank you for listening.